This edition of the Monocle Weekly was first broadcast on the 1st of June 2014 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to the 256th edition of the Monocle Weekly with me, Robert Bounds, and Andrew Tuck.
Coming up in the show, we'll sit down with the former chief exec of BP, Lord Brown, to discuss his new book, The Glass Closet: Why Coming Out is Good Business.
And acclaimed writer Jeff Dyer will tell us of his experiences aboard a US naval carrier for his new book, Another Great Day at Sea.
And finally, we look to the immigrant experience in America with Christina Enriquez, who provides insights from her new novel, The Book of Unknown Americans.
Lots to look forward to. That's all to come on the Monocle Weekly with me, Robert Bounds, and Andrew Tuck. I feel like, you know, at the beginning of the show, we have what we call the bed.
Yes.
Underneath us talking about under the menu.
You fancy a bed, do you?
I quite fancy a bed. I have to be honest. This afternoon, Andrew, I feel like it's been a long and weary week. But I mean, I felt energized most of the week. I think maybe I tailed off a bit towards the end. How about you?
You've been a starter. No, it's been a good week. We finished the July August double issue.
Yep.
Which ranks the top 25 cities to call home, and the winner this year is. You'll have to buy the magazine.
I thought it was a spoiler alert.
No, I wasn't going to spoil anything.
I thought you were going to let a particular feline out of a particular sort of sack.
Yeah, Steve Bloomfield, who's been kind of overseeing all the metrics, he's got very fraught all week over the number of art galleries in Copenhagen, the murder rate in Helsinki.
Steve is a man who you can imagine quite likes wielding a clipboard.
Yes.
He's been walking around the office ticking things off all week.
And the murder rate.
He's been in his element.
The murder rate in London nearly went up one or two, I think.
I know, exactly. I think London slipped considerably down the rankings just because it had to be the house in which Monocle magazine was situated this week. It's been quite a good one. We've kind of put the juggling balls.
Yes.
In the air.
The balls are well.
Always
well
make sure when your balls are in the air, they're juggling balls, because otherwise it just makes it look like you're a man.
You don't know where you're going with that, do you? Now, can I just say that the introduction to the show is a power ballad of a turnout, isn't it? Oh, my God.
I know. We've got some really good... I'm really looking forward to meeting Jeff Dyer, one of my favourite writers. He's one of those people, isn't he, that you kind of feel that he can turn his hand to anything. He's a great example to anyone who wields a pen in anger.
Yeah, as you say, his kind of name appears on all sorts of things. And, yeah, he's kind of a gentle soul, so it'd be interesting to see what it was like being aboard the USS George H.W. Bush.
Okay. the only person I know that would put so much emphasis on Bush.
On Bush. And it's a surprise as well. And then we have Lord Brown later on as well. So lots of nice things coming up. Is that enough for lots?
I think that's enough lots. Do you know what happens at this point in the show? You know who we put in the little wheelbarrow and we wheel him into the studio?
It's old Cheery Edwards.
It's old Cheery Tom Edwards. He always comes in, doesn't he, with his news look ahead in a piece of paper in his inside jacket pocket.
I know.
Like a sort of useless spy. Anyway,
I think it's time to
open the studio door and allow in the one and only Tom Edwards.
And now, from London, Camden's king of current affairs, the man who put the eek into Monocle Weekly... The ooh into the news. He once wrestled an angry mongoose. He doesn't sleep. He waits. He's about to open a can of whoop-ass on your week. And it's not even Monday. Undefeated, unflappable, and pretty much unheard of outside of digital radio. It's Monocle 24's news editor, Mr. Tom Edwards.
Woo! Oh, yeah.
Hoo-ha. We've just opened a big can of Tom Edwards.
Here he is.
Hi, Tom. How you doing?
Rob, Andrew, I'm well. How are you this beautiful Sunday?
Very well indeed, thank you.
I'm just trying to wipe the Tom Edwards off my fingers. Big can of it.
Oh, that's...
Perish the thought.
This has gone... This has started exactly how I didn't want it to begin. See if we can bring it back, shall we?
Come back.
Let's rescue it. Andrew, here's a hanky.
Okay.
And let's start the news look ahead.
Well, from that introduction, let's talk about Ukraine and gas importation.
Oh, that's...
No, tomorrow is the deadline for Ukraine to pay its bills for advanced gas imports from Gazprom in Russia. They have to pay about $1.5 billion of forecasted imports each time. It may not have escaped people's attentions that there's some awkward relationships between the two countries. And Gazprom said it's going to cut them off if they don't start paying in advance.
But there's a whole kind of dispute, isn't it, about kind of, you know, how much should be paid, what the price, you know, per cubic meter is, you know, why they've jumped up the price. It feels like one of those things that they will never actually kind of be paying a rate that everybody's happy with. And it seems to be a way of leveraging cash out the EU and all sorts of things. It's the most complicated argument.
It's hugely complex. And each of these sort of deadlines seems to, you know, announce another different shift in the sort of the tensions between the two countries. Will tomorrow see any kind of lasting agreement? Frankly, I doubt it.
Okay.
I thought I'd just mention that all of the football squads for the World Cup need to be submitted tomorrow, Andrew.
Okay.
Oh, right, okay. So am I? So I've still got a chance then?
You've not been ruled out yet, Rob.
Okay, phew.
It would be a surprise inclusion, but stranger things have happened.
If I get overlooked, I'll probably just tweet my international retirement.
That's the choice, that's
what they do.
Some players have been tweeting that retirement without ever having played for said international
yes,
countries.
Yes, I love that.
Which I think is kind of
I'm going to rule myself out. Okay.
It's like, I'm 38. I've never been picked so far.
Razor Ruddock's not playing, apparently.
He's been overlooked once again.
Yeah.
But that's kind of a special interest.
I sat next to a woman this week who knew rather a lot about football because her husband's a presenter, and she realised that I knew nothing about it, and she said, "Will you be watching the World Cup?" And I said, "Oh yeah, I like the World Cup because it's kind of like Eurovision, isn't it?" And there was a look, and she thought, "No, it's not like Eurovision at all.
You don't know how this works."
Andrew was sitting next to Mrs. Clive Tildesley.
I was.
Yeah, he was.
I was.
Oh, I thought that was a gag.
No, that was a gag.
No, right. Oh, well,
Susan.
Know.
Yeah,
she was very nice.
Looking forward
to
hearing the wisdom of Clive. We'll be looking forward to that over the coming weeks. Presidential elections, just chalk off some of those. Tuesday, Syria.
Tick.
They've had a few issues, I think it's safe to say. And a quite interesting phenomenon has been happening. You know, people, sort of expat communities, refugees, have had to leave Syria trying to go and vote at embassies in other countries. Quite a lot of the people who fled the country backing Assad, sort of counterintuitively, because I think it might make it easier for them to be able to return. It's a better way of getting stability going forwards. He is obviously seeking another term. I think it's safe to say he's probably going to win. But he has allowed other candidates to oppose him. So, you know, there's a nod to some kind of loose democratic process. But it's pretty grim, and it looks like he should coast home fairly easily.
Thanks for cheering us up with that one. Have you got anything nice?
I've got some other things. Well, this is kind of...
Talk about Clive Tilsey's wife.
We could talk about Clive Tilsey a bit more. Or okay. Normandy landings on Friday. 70 years, of course, since that day. It was so important in the whole shifting the balance of the Second World War. And all sorts of big hitters are heading to Normandy to commemorate the event, including, intriguingly, we were talking about Ukraine and Russia at the beginning, Vladimir Putin is still set to attend. He's been invited along, as has Petro Poroshenko, newly elected Ukrainian president. Will they be exchanging pleasantries? One rather suspects not.
Probably not. They probably won't be sharing a cab from Dunkirk Airport.
But it would be... But you'd like to think that maybe being around the symbolism, the sort of incredible historical weight that is implicit always when you go to those kinds of events. Maybe that...
Maybe we should sort of
might help them along the way.
Anniversary for the Charge of the Light Brigade. Feel better about it.
That could work.
They should go for a little walk on the beach.
Well, maybe they could. Chat. Take a stroll. Have a bit of a powwow.
Could have some whelks.
I love a whelk.
Okay.
I've just got to give you one final one.
Yes, please.
A bit of levity. Also on Friday, once we've commemorated D-Day, because that'll be a sad occasion.
laughing about the whelks.
I think they'd enjoy a whelk.
Yeah.
They could have some whelks.
Whelk peace.
Whelk peace, that's terrible. It's National National Donut Day.
Okay. Have you noticed what's happening with donuts?
Is this to do with National Donut Day?
Well, kind of. There's all these crazy flavours coming out. I was with somebody yesterday and they had like lemonade flavoured donut.
Oh, I don't know about that.
What, the cream inside?
Yeah, but they're doing like crazy donuts these days.
Quite like an apple one, like a sort of apple donut instead of a cream donut. I mean, I like a jam donut.
Yeah, the classic. I think jam is the only way.
So how is this being celebrated?
Well, it's the first Friday of June every year. It began to raise money for the Salvation Army in Chicago in the US. And a lot of stores are just offering free donuts. I don't know about the flavours, Andrew.
Well, I wouldn't mind a free donut.
But I don't know, what if you're like, here's a free donut, you'd be overexcited. Then if it was, say, lemonade, you'd be like, oh.
I'd still have it. I'd try it out.
Really?
Yeah.
I like an iced donut, actually.
Oh, with a sort of glaze?
Yeah, a glaze. Yeah.
Yeah. Rob, what would you go for? If it just one, then what? Classic glaze, plain.
And I'm gonna have I'm gonna have plain glaze, please.
I just go for a raspberry jam donut, a classic.
Yeah, classic.
I like it in a paper bag where the grease and the sugar is going through, making the bag transparent. You can taste a bit of the paper bag in the donut. It's delicious. I think it's very, very hard to improve on any.
I'm gonna go and get donuts now.
Thanks.
Just for me.
Oh, okay.
Well, thank you for that, Tom. That was an excellent news look ahead. What was your favourite beer?
Talking about donuts.
Yeah, me too. Andrew?
Donuts.
And your Welks.
And my Welks.
What about a Welk donut?
Ooh.
Oh, Heston Blumenthal, be gone.
He'd have a field day with that, wouldn't he?
Yeah, exactly.
Pop it in the hole.
And what's happening next? What's happening after Tom's news look ahead? Oh, we're going to be talking to the former head of BP about coming out in the big business world. That's Lord Brown coming up next. Despite much progress, being gay is an issue that many still feel the need to keep quiet about, especially in big business. Our next guest kept that side to his life secret until when chief exec of BP in 2007, he resigned after admitting he'd lied to a court about his private life.
The Glass Closet, Why Coming Out is Good for Business, is a personal memoir that underlines the author's case for the book's stated purpose. Lord Brown argues that businesses and economies will only thrive when people function as their authentic selves, suggesting that in the world of business, there is still much work to do. And Lord Brown joins us now. Thank you so much for coming to see us. Let me ask you first about that pivotal moment when you decided to resign. You'd been forced into a situation where you hadn't been able to tell the truth you felt about your sexuality. Looking back now, where now you've come out and you've told the world not just about your sexuality, but about the life you wish to lead, does that period of your life seem very distant?
It seems distant and different. And resigning, which I was determined to do, it was very clearly the right thing to do. And I did it when the court case was resolved. Was a full stop on one chapter of life and a start of another. A rather amazing, unexpected life where I've done such things as written three books. This is my third book.
And can I just quickly ask you that you're obviously telling a story which I still think people don't realise is still relevant for many people in business, not just about whether you're gay, but whoever you are, this idea of being this honesty and integrity in business, that the idea that you keep things away from your bosses because you feel it may not be palatable to them. How much do you think that has changed today in big business? Or do you think there are many people, young people indeed, still forced into situations where they're careful about what they say about their private life for fear that it's going to kind of, you know, stop them being promoted, that stop them climbing up the career ladder?
Well, that's what I found when I read the book. I was surprised that there were people who were the 30-something person who were still in the closet in business and a bit out in their private lives, but they were very concerned that it might get in the way, would get in the way, and could be damaging to their success in business. And the worst thing is they had no role model to look at to say, actually, he did it or she did it, and they did fine. So there were very few role models. And one of the points of the book is to give people a chance to see role models, both in the book and, I hope, a lasting item, the website which goes with the book, glasscloset.org, which is about stories of people who've come out and the good side of that. So I think that's really important. These role models are essential, and the absence of them makes it tough for people to say, well, I hear what you say, it's great to come out, but actually I'm not going to come out.
And why do you think business is particularly bad?
Well, business has not been that good with a slightly simpler issue called gender. We all talk about, you know, the difficulty in getting women on corporate boards, but it's even more difficult getting women in the so-called C-suite below the board level. Mm. And it's something to do with probably unconscious bias of people who select. It's people who feel comfortable with people like them. They don't want to see people who are that different. And so people select in their own image, as it were. Now, I believe that's changing and that's very important. And we should, you know, merit should be the only thing that matters here. Fitness for purpose for the job and great ideas, great way of working. That happens in lots of other sectors of society where people are probably less part of a big institution, more individual, much more individual. So whether that's in sport with single performers like divers, compared with sport in big teams like football, there's a difference in the way in which people behave. Same is probably true in enterprise. But it's, I think, really important because every study you see says set the right climate. If people are themselves, if they're authentic at work, they perform so much better. They're so much more productive, so much more creative, and they get things done.
Can I ask you if you think there's a bit of a contemporary trap in all of this? I'm struck by the number of people I know who work, for example, in the city. They work for big banks that now have kind of whole policies around, you know, diversity, and they have groups, they encourage groups to meet around diversity. And I know that people who work in those institutions who've said to me, actually, I still don't really want to come out work because my fear is, you know, this is done because my bank doesn't want to get sued. It wants to say, do you know, one day if somebody comes along and says, you know, we didn't get ahead at work, they say, well, actually, we put money aside for this. We backed it. We were supportive. Friends have said to me that actually when it comes to it in the boardroom, they still prejudice against gay people.
So I think a lot of this depends on the tone from the real top. When the CEO, he or she says, I want this to happen. I really do believe that we should make sure that LGBT people can be themselves at work, and I want to hold people to account to make sure that happens, then it begins to happen. I think if you delegate it just to processes and procedures inside the company, often in the hands of very well-meaning HR, human resources managers, it's a very different experience. People, you're right, look at it and say, well, this is part of what companies have to do. It's not something they really want me to do. And I won't turn up to this. And a lot of people have noticed that these great LGBT networks often have lacking the presence of any senior people, much more junior people, people away from the main line sometimes. This is happening in all companies. You know, at the moment, there is no openly gay CEO in the S&P 500. And I was speaking to a guy the other day who's very senior in what he described as a post-gay corporation. And of the top...
What's that mean?
I don't know. But it sounded very good. The top 100 senior officers, there's only one out gay person. Now, that's statistics. Yeah. All of
statistically
these...
Statistically impossible.
They tend to deny statistics, yeah. They do. Yeah.
Does it surprise you, oddly, that in some instances, you know, something like, you know, Boris Johnson's administration, the Tory party, the military... have oddly done better in many instances than many of these companies that seem to have quite, you know, liberal, outgoing personalities. But when it comes down to it, they haven't actually been able to match these very, you know, conservative institutions for reform.
Well, politics, for sure, has taken a great lead in this, whether it's in the US or the UK, for example, and in Europe. And people have said, look, I need to be authentic in politics. I've got to come out. And so people are out. And very comfortable with it. And there are very few people who probably would run the risk of being in the closet in politics. It's one of the things that people could use to blackmail you or bully you into doing some things. So I think that's moved ahead hugely. I think media moved ahead hugely. Some parts of the law, probably not in the big structured law firms, but in other parts like barristers and things like that, that's great. And the army's decided as a result of public policy to begin to let people be out. Whether everybody's out in the military remains to be seen.
It's interesting you talk about the media. You know, I worked on Fleet Street for a long time. Yes, a number of gay people, but they were always the theatre critic. They were always the arts critic. You know, I never worked on a newspaper where the business editor was gay. I never worked on a newspaper where the editor was gay. I always looked around at gay people at work on those newspapers, and I was aware, even in very liberal newspapers, people were cautious about being too out, in a sense, because they felt that they would get lumped with every gay story, that they would be the go-to person for anything that was like, you know, gay pride, okay, you go and cover it. You could very easily get pushed into one corner. And I think that's the problem with, you know, for big businesses as well. You know, again, you encourage people to come out, and then they suddenly become the token, the person to go to.
Well, that's why I think in this book, what I've tried to do is write a letter to straight people.
Yeah, I was going to ask you that.
The bulk of the world is straight. And so some of this book, it's called a book about gay people and gay people getting a sense of confidence by looking at what other people have done and also avoiding getting in the mess that I got into. But there's also a whole part of this book, which is about how do we get the majority of the world, which is straight, to understand how to deal with the environment in which people who are gay can come out. How do they make it safe for people to do that? And that's really important.
And I wanted to ask you how exhausting it is having to
dodge around
and weave around.
It's very exhausting.
Whether you're at a low level or whether you're at a high level, and you've obviously been at both in the same company.
You know, I speak for myself. Yeah. I mean, when you start, of course, it's almost kind of fun. I mean, you have a sort of James Bond approach to this. You know, you have a legend and you have the reality and you keep them separate. As time goes on, it gets pretty exhausting and gets more difficult because you get to be more noticed, more people know you. It's more difficult to keep their lives separate. And so it's never a desirable thing to do. But then you get hooked by it because the moment you start on that track, you have to decide when to stop. And
it becomes less and less easy
and
to
most
do
people,
so.
Yes, exactly, because the fears in your head, which very rarely come about to be true, are all about rejection, about fear of losing your job, about fear of losing clients, about fear of being unable to go to foreign countries, you know, the ones in the oil industry.
Well,
I know
you talked about Russia and going to say farewell to Putin. Yes. That must have been a weird...
That was before I came out.
But I know, but, you know, it must have been...
Oh, yes, I had many meetings with Mr. Putin. But I think, though, you know, if you're out right at the very top of a very important company, probably people are prepared to sort of make you honorary straight and to deal with you in those countries. I think the real danger there is if you're in the middle of the company, you have to be very careful how the company deals with you when you go to some of the countries where it's criminal to be gay.
What are a few things you think that companies need to do to make this work?
I think the first thing they have to do, though, is to look after the safety of the employee. It's the number one thing. And one of the reasons why I really think people do need to come out of work is for the employer to know that they're gay. Because if they don't know, then they could be put in a terribly difficult and dangerous position. Secondly, I think there are areas you can push the limits, provided it's safe, where you can take a partner or you can, you know, be gay as long as you don't do things which are to the point of slapping the authorities in the face. But equally, that allows a company to push the limits a bit. And I think pushing limits is what companies should be doing. They can't change the law, but they can influence behavior a bit. And I think that's really very important to remember. Companies are not passive. They're entities that mold society, part of society, not all of society, and they have a responsibility to do that.
There's people like you that can mold the companies.
Well, I'm making up for lost time in some ways that, getting this out there and saying, look, I've been there and I've done it and I think I understand something about leading a company because I've done that. Here's what I think leaders should do. And here's how I think people should think about themselves, which is, you know, if in doubt, just come out. You know.
Well, John Brown, Lord Brown, thank you very much for joining us on the Monocle Weekly. The book is The Glass Closet, Why Coming Out is Good for Business, or is Good Business. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
Let's take a little break for some music now. This is new from St. Vincent. It's called Digital Witness. It's from the album that came out, the eponymous album that came out earlier this year. Here she is.
Good. Cycle.
And that was Digital Witness, new from St. Vincent. Another great at sea, life aboard the USS George H.W. Bush, is the latest work by our next guest, celebrated writer Jeff Dyer. It's the first book in the Alain de Botton contrived Writers in Residence series that places writers and photographers in infrastructures of the modern world.
Here, Jeff Dyer finds himself aboard the USS George H.W. Bush naval carrier in what he terms another world, putting together this act of embedded documentary over 2 weeks with the help of his photographer, Chris Steele Perkins, his notepad and his tape recorder. And Jeff joins us now. Jeff, a great book. Now, let's just first of all explain what it is. It's kind of a book. It's kind of a magazine almost in format. It's kind of photography. It's kind of long form writing. It feels a little bit hybrid. What's the idea about this book?
Yeah, well, design wise, that is really unfortunate to hear you say that, because unfortunately it confirms my sort of sense of what it looks like. Yeah, it looks like one of those incredibly expensive art magazines that you flick through in a bookshop and then don't buy.
Luckily, this one's got some.
Well, of course, you
good,
people
decent
don't,
words
don't,
in it.
Don't ever buy things, but yeah, the American edition has got fewer pictures, and it very much looks like a book rather than a magazine. So yeah, that's regrettable. In terms of let's say it is a book, though it's meant to be a book. Then it's a kind of collaboration, I guess, between me and the photographer. But it's a somewhat lopsided collaboration, because the deal was that in exchange for spending these 2 weeks on the George H.W. Bush, I would write 35,000 words to justify my free trip. Fine, you know, happy to do that. It seemed like a lot of words, actually, to me. But then what I did, I ended up writing 70,000 words, thinking that I would cut them down to, you know, 35. And then I found I'd become incredibly attached to all but 5,000 of them. So it really outgrew the brief and became a much more peculiar book than perhaps anyone imagined it would be. So let's put it like this. It ended up being a book by me more than it ended up being a sort of written to order, fulfilling the commission kind of book.
And I wanted to ask you a little bit about the genesis of it as well. We mentioned in the intro, Alain de Botton has put this thing together, Writers in Residence. I can imagine a wonderful tussle between two great writers, contemporary writers, where one, essentially, Alain de Botton, is trying to finish you off by sending you into a very dangerous environment, saying, oh, yeah, why don't you write a book, Jeff? I know that's not how he speaks. but presumably it must have been something that he might have been itching to do himself. How did it work, like being commissioned to do it, basically?
Yeah, it grew out of the little book that he did when he was writer in residence at Heathrow.
At Heathrow, yeah.
And then he had this idea of maybe putting writers in residence in unusual places, and got in touch with me, not to say, you're going to an aircraft carrier, pack your bags, you know, here's the ticket. He asked very nicely if there was somewhere interesting that I might like to go. And it didn't require much thought on my part to realize, first of all, this is, you know, a great opportunity to get somewhere interesting. But also I realized it would be crazy to go anywhere that I might have access to in the course of my normal life. So, you know, the more closed the environment, the better. And, you know, you narrow that down further. And, you know, it seemed really a good idea to go to somewhere, a military kind of place. And at the top of my list, actually, was this idea of getting on an aircraft carrier, which I thought it was, you know, since he said, is there somewhere I would like to go? I thought I'd just say, yeah, it's this, thinking it would never happen.
Like it's a magic carpet of a commission, really. Well, it can take you anywhere.
Exactly. And then, you know, it's difficult enough, as you know, applying for a US visa. That's incredibly complicated. Behind the scenes, apparently, getting me on this boat was incredibly time-consuming. Just last night, de Botton said it was the most difficult thing he'd ever done. Anyway, a certain amount of time went by, and next thing, you know, I'm in Bahrain at the naval base, and then we're flying on a plane onto the carrier.
You think of a ship like this as kind of a closed community in many ways. These people have trained together, they live together, they have a single kind of ambition in many senses about what they're there to do. They know what their job is. An outsider comes on board. How did they respond to you wandering around, quizzing them everything about their kind of egg order to the kind of the ammunition they have on board.
Well, as is always the case with Americans, they're incredibly friendly, unbelievably polite. You go from London to America and you're always struck by the level of courtesy and politeness in America generally. And this was raised to an incredible degree, partly because in a world like that, where although the carrier is very big, there are 5,000 people on board, so it's very, very cramped. Courtesy, politeness, you know, this kind of stuff becomes much more important as a way of avoiding any kind of friction in this claustrophobic environment where people are on a 7-month deployment. And they were additionally nice to me, not just because, you know, the captain had broadcast on the ship, there's this sort of journalist on board, make sure you're all on your best behaviour, but because I was a civilian, you know, that automatically made me the recipient of their goodwill. Beyond all that kind of thing, I mean, it seemed to me we got on incredibly well, because as well as politeness being a big part of an environment like that, of course, joking, bantering, all this kind of stuff plays a big part. And once you use the B word, the bantering word, of course, that's meat and drink to anybody English, isn't it? You know,
is it one of those cases though, where we're not separated by a common language in that respect? Because politeness is maybe we can talk about that first. But
yeah, well, we were separated by this common language, because in one of the first sort of really lame jokes I made, I said to the guy, wow, this is the most AIE I've ever been in. And he said, what do you mean? I said, acronym intensive environment. And, you know,
his rifle, looked over his shoulder and asked you where.
And so, yeah, it's an incredibly technical environment, and it's just loaded with these acronyms. And I just kind of loved all that. Yeah. Ever since seeing that series on TV, you know, Generation Kill, where you've got those Marines in their Humvees, it's very difficult not to feel an attraction for that kind of military speak.
I did a story once on the American Forces Network, which you might have watched some of when you're on the carrier, which is a 14-channel network that covers all of the American bases and all the aircraft carriers and everywhere around the world that's sort of covered by the American forces. And I went to the Pentagon as part of that story as well. And it's interesting your thing on politeness, because I always found it to be a thinnish varnish, actually.
Oh, did you?
It's a sort of what I think there was a sort of white knuckled decorum. Everyone is almost shaking with politeness, that it's an effort. And I suppose it's a control thing. Did you find that it changed depending upon the hierarchy, or did you find that there was a lovely glaze of politeness?
Yeah, no. First of all, I wish we'd met before I went on this so I could have paid you £1 for world rights for the use of that great phrase. Yeah, I mean, it's difficult to say how sort of deep it went, because, you know, I was only there for 2 weeks.
Yeah.
For example, just to sort of expand on that point, after I got back, I heard from various different people that on a carrier like this, which seemed to me the very model of racial integration and harmony, in fact, there are gangs on board and there are certain bits of the carrier which people in other gangs don't go to. Now, I saw no evidence of that, since the book is entirely experiential based on what I've seen. I couldn't write about it. And I don't think I'd have been able to come to any kind of understanding of that, or I wouldn't have witnessed that kind of thing if I'd been on the carrier for another 2 weeks. For that kind of thing, you really need to be that you needed sort of deep immersion in a place. That's the kind of thing that you would get to grips with when you get to know people really, really well, and you've been around so long, like a kind of, you know, like a sort of documentary crew, whereby people get so used to the camera being around, it disappears.
I wanted to ask you about how you approached the task, whether you researched it or whether you wanted to very much approach, whether it was very much a blank slate, purposefully so.
There wasn't the need to do a great deal of research. I mean, I'd read a load of...
Did you have your little sort of I Spy guide of acronyms in your back pocket?
Well, you know, I did a certain amount of research in sort of, you know, the history of the aircraft carrier, which actually is not a very interesting thing, because really, once you'd got the idea of it, you know, actually try to have a very flat platform on the sea from which you can launch boats. After that, it's just a question of technological refinements to that basic idea. You know, I've reached the age really where, what do I want to read? Military history.
Like so Keith Richards.
It is he the same?
Is it the same? All he reads about, apparently.
Really? Aha.
Jeff meet Keith. Keith meet Jeff. We'll do that later.
Yeah. So I mean, it's I'd read a lot of this stuff anyway, and it was, I'm tempted to say, it was kind of in my, not exactly in my blood, but, you know, I was born in 1958, so I was intimately acquainted with the Phantom Jet by having built them as a kid doing Airfix models, you know. So, yeah, it was very, it felt quite familiar to me, this kind of stuff.
And maybe finally, can I just ask you about the actual kind of the military might and the purpose of those people on the ship? Because, you know, there's the observational detail and the way that this thing functions as an organism. It comes across in the book in an amazing way. But in the end, they're there potentially to kill people and fire rockets and to, you know, we've seen them off the coast of Libya being involved there. They're there for a military reason. How much of that do you feel was important to bring out in the book as well?
Yeah, really, really good point. And, you know, there was a time when the warrior caste, they had no desire to express their function in terms other than how many heads they could chop off. And that persisted for many centuries. Now, of course, the military in any kind of, you know, democratic country has to pass itself off as a force for global well-being. So they were very keen to say, you know, everyone knows we can rain destruction on their heads 24 hours a day, but actually we can do all this kind of stuff with disaster relief and we can help out, blah, 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 all this kind of stuff. And I remember that conversation, it ended on that note. And I really wished I'd added a line after that saying, you know, and if they don't like that, then we can still rain destruction on them. So yes, you're absolutely right. But one of the things, it's quite specific to America, there's this absolute belief in the mission, irrespective of the larger value of that mission. And there's an even bigger commitment in this idea of service, serving your country. And I think the sort of self-interrogation doesn't go much beyond that. And in terms of the book, I felt because it was all very much based on what I could see, this wasn't the kind of book in which it would be appropriate to get involved in a discussion about the rights and wrongs of the invasion of Iraq. For the record, of course, it was a catastrophic mistake, I think.
Well, Jeff, we could have spoken all day about another... We should have spoken for a whole day about another day, great day at sea. And life aboard the USS George H.W. Bush sounds rather addictive. Thank you very much for your time on the Monocle Weekly.
Well, thank you both very much. Thank you for having me.
We'll be back after this short break with Christina Enriquez, who's going to be talking about her new novel, The Book of Unknown Americans.
The Monocle app has all the details of what's coming up on Monocle 24 and offers you the chance to catch up on shows you might have missed. You can download programs to your mobile or tablet to listen offline and set reminders of all your favorites. It also has one-tap access to the latest news reports from our editors and correspondents around the world. The 2525 is Monocle's insider guide to the world's premier resort and business cities. The app features recommendations for the best hotels, restaurants, and retail opportunities, along with GPS directions, ensuring Monocle is your one-stop guide to city hopping. You can even give us feedback on personal favorites you've discovered on your travels. The Monocolumn is Instapaper supported and available to read on your mobile, fully integrated to fit any size and screen. The Monocle app is available through iTunes and at monocle.com. Monocle, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
The immigrant experience in America has long been fodder for novelists trying to make sense of the hope that USA can hold for newcomers, coupled with the often complex and harsh reality of assimilation.
In the Book of Unknown Americans, author Christina Enriquez tells the story of the multiple voices of the American immigrant experience, recounting the tales of the displaced, newly arrived, and the unknown through one family's story and that of a Panamanian boy and Mexican girl. The author Christina Enriquez joins us now. Welcome to the show. Before we start diving into your book, you know, all of us in the modern world have seemed to have some connections with migrant stories. We know people, we work with people, we're surrounded by people on the subway every day whose stories are unfolding in very interesting and fascinating ways. For you, before we dive into the book, where does your your understanding of this world come from?
My father came from Panama to the United States in 1971. So this is a story and a book that was inspired mostly by him. And the idea that there's a certain way that immigrants are portrayed in the media and in literature. And I wanted to sort of tell his story and stories like his, which was that he came to study chemical engineering at the University of Delaware. He thought he would go back. He ended up meeting my mom. And, you know, sort of the rest is history. But he's been in the United States for over 40 years now.
So part of the key thing for you is, you know, that perspective, because we're always kind of almost in the media, we're kind of looking at migrants. We're hearing what we think is their stories. But this is a chance to be on the other side of the fence to kind of look at the story through the eyes of actually people who've made that journey.
Yeah, I mean, it was a very personal story for me. It was something that came, you know, from a life of living with my father and seeing his struggles. And, you know, he's gone on. He's been a very successful person in his industry and his family and all that kind of stuff. But I still see the struggles that he deals with every day.
I mean, it's a book with a lot of every chapter is a different character and it's all first person. Mm-hmm. That's quite a tough thing to write, isn't it? To get into the head of your characters.
Yeah, there were 11.
Was that the challenge or the stories the challenge? it's made you into a fractious person.
No, I mean, I think maybe I already am anyway in a weird way. So like I walk around and I hear voices in my head and, you know, so I just I was trying to capture them on the page, you know, and I wanted all of them to have unique experiences. These are all characters who are from various countries in Latin America. And one of my goals also was, I feel like there's a tendency to think of immigrants as sort of like one mass of humanity. And I wanted to differentiate them and make them, you know, really individuals on the page and in the story.
The novel is called The Book of Unknown Americans. Is it an American novel? Because you are, or do you think it is this strange beast, this sort of mismatch of all these different voices?
It's interesting. It was very important to me to include the word American in the title, in the sense that these are all characters who are living in the United States and that they think of themselves as American. So there's a certain form of like political assertion that's made when you're, you know, using that term, because there's a lot of people around them who might not call them Americans, even though they would call themselves that. Mm-hmm. But in another way, I mean, I think it's just sort of a global story. It's a story about, you know, learning to have empathy for people who are unlike you or people who you may not think about every day or, you know, who are basically unknown to you. And in a way, I was hoping that the book would make these people known.
You arrive in Europe and in the UK, a very interesting moment. We've just had the European elections, a huge debate going on here about migration. And it's always been a slightly different story to in the US. But certainly here in Europe, you see, you know, people trying to put up barriers to stop what seems kind of inevitable. You know, you imagine if you were one of these people and you saw the promise of kind of giving your family a better life by moving. I always wonder what I would do. I would move. And, you know, that's, you know, so migration seems kind of unstoppable. Does it kind of interest you when you come to Europe and you see the debate that's going on here? Does it feel similar to that in the US? Because I know in the US, you know, that there's, in fact, the migrant community is a bit more powerful and it's certainly making demands about what should be done, a little bit more organized even. But does it feel a slightly different story on both sides of the Atlantic?
I think it feels a little bit different in the sense of the demographic. And I can say for sure, I've been only here, this is my first trip to the UK, and I've only been here now for about 3 days. So I can't say for sure, but
judge.
I do know that it's a very, very fraught discussion right now in the United States. And, you know, I mean, again, I think to me, it's just a human thing. It isn't necessarily about specific countries and about specific borders. That was part of the goal of this book, too, was I felt like, you know, immigration is a system, and I don't necessarily know that I wrote a book about immigration, but I feel that I wrote a book about immigrants and about that human side of, you know, that longing and the challenges and the struggles and of just being anywhere new. I mean, I felt that even being here myself, I have this self-consciousness at this moment of sounding very American, you know, like that my accent is very American. So even that, you know, but then to multiply that times 1,000, or, you know, for somebody who has speaking a completely different language and going somewhere and trying to make a life.
When
you
what?
when you're kind of second generation from a family who, you know, from a father who moved to the United States, does that story begin to change you? Because, you know, in the book, for example, one of the very first stories begins with, you know, somebody on a truck crossing the border. That's, you know, we're there at the very beginning moment of their migrants' story. Now, for you, that's a bit distant now, that, and your dad, as you say, came to kind of study. You know, how did you get into the heads of all these characters who actually were actually a few stages, you know, even generations behind you, literally crossing the border in a truck?
I hope I did. You know, I was mostly just exercise in invention and imagination and, you know, empathetic thinking about what that would feel like for anyone. I mean, you know, I mean, I had that experience seeing my dad, but my own experience, of course, has been different. And it actually is sort of a lot more like, there's a young 16-year-old boy in the book named Mayor, and he was born in Panama, but was raised most of his life in the United States. And he says, you know, at points that he feels more American than anything. I was born in the United States and I feel American, but it's interesting. I'm becoming more aware of people's perceptions of me and my identity and how sometimes people don't see me as fully American, which is so bizarre to me since I've lived there my whole life.
Perhaps we should let the listeners hear a little bit of some of the voices that are in the book. I know that you've marked in the book a little bit that you've kindly offered to read for us. And so we should begin to kind of hear how the book kind of sounds.
Yeah, this is just a little bit from the beginning, from one of the narrators, as you mentioned, right after they've arrived in the United States. Her name is Alma. Back then, all we wanted was the simplest things. To eat good food, to sleep at night, to smile, to laugh, to be well. We felt it was our right, as much as it was anyone's, to have those things. Of course, when I think about it now, I see that I was naive. I was blinded by the swell of hope and the promise of possibility. I assumed that everything that would go wrong in our lives already had. 30 hours after crossing the border, we arrived, the three of us in the back seat of a red pickup truck that smelled of cigarette smoke and gasoline. "Wake up," I whispered, nudging Maribel as the driver turned into a parking lot. "Hmm? We're here, hija." "Where?" Maribel asked. "Delaware." She blinked at me in the dark. Arturo was sitting on the other side of us. "Is she okay?" he asked. "Don't worry," I said. "She's fine." It was just after sunset and darkness bled in from the outer reaches of the sky. A few minutes earlier, we'd been on a busy road, driving through four-way intersections, past strip malls and fast food restaurants. But as we neared the apartment building, all of that had given way. The driver parked the truck and lit another cigarette. He'd been smoking the whole trip. It gave him something to do with his mouth, I guess, since he'd made it clear from the moment he picked us up in Laredo that he wasn't interested in conversation. Arturo climbed out first, straightened his cowboy hat, and surveyed the building. Two stories made of cinder blocks and cement, an outdoor walkway that ran the length of the second floor with metal staircases at either end, pieces of broken styrofoam in the grass, a chain-link fence along the perimeter of the lot, cracks in the asphalt. I had expected it to be nicer, something with white shutters and red bricks, something with manicured shrubs and flower boxes in the windows, the way American houses looked in movies. This was the only option Arturo's new job had given us, though, and I told myself we were lucky to have it.
Beautifully read as well. Amazing. That's good, isn't it? Just be able to come in and do that.
Amazing.
I wanted to ask you, how fictional are those stories?
Because I mean, completely.
I wonder whether you had to, whether you had to canvas people, whether there was any, you know.
I had a thought at one time that maybe I would include actual interviews with real people throughout the course of the book, and then I don't know. I just went back to my own fictional impulses and
so that
invented
pickup truck
them
outside
all.
Is just completely. Yeah, it's just a coincidence.
All made up.
And sorry,
I was just going to say that what was interesting when you read that piece is, which I think is a common theme of migration, is that sense of slight delusion and kind of feeling a bit kind of anticlimactic once you've actually made that journey, that actually what seemed so the promised land, when you get there, is full of complications. And if your life is complicated and you've had difficult times, those times kind of come with you as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think, yeah, that idea that, you know, maybe they had seen a certain image of what it was going to be like through a movie, and then you get there and there's that sort of disappointment in a way, or, you know, you've been very hopeful. You, they say in another point, they've pinned all their dreams on this place, you know, and it's like you just want that pin to hold and you're just not sure if it's going to.
Well, Christina, thank you so much for coming in. The book is The Book of Unknown Americans by Christina Hernandez. Why can't I? That's me trying to read your name upside down. It's pretty bad, isn't it? I'll redo that. So that's that way up. That's that way up, and that's that way up. Christina, thank you very much for coming in and talking to us on the Monocle Weekly. The book is The Book of Unknown Americans. Christina Enriquez, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
We managed to do that whole show without falling into a bed.
We did.
We kept it up.
We stayed fresh and perky throughout the whole thing. What a great show.
I really enjoyed doing today's show. I thought all our guests were wonderful. I thought they were diverse and fascinating. And I think we could have made a whole show, a whole day of programming built around any one of our guests, actually.
And
Lord Brown was an interesting character, wasn't he?
Really fascinating. And it is really interesting to think that he kind of had this semi-open secret. He says, I think in the book, that some people around him did kind of probably know, but it was just never commented on.
Yeah.
But he kind of kept this lie going for so long, and he was such a powerful character in many ways that this small thing about his personality, about his life, his private life, he just felt impossible to talk about. And it's crazy when you think that there must be so many other people still like him, stuck in the same miserable situation.
He talks about it very well, and I guess it takes someone right at the top of the pile like that to talk about it, to make it sort of, to make it trickle down.
And he was amusing.
He's amusing. He was a good talker.
Yes. And I loved Christina coming in. It was great, actually, to just hear her read. She's a good reader.
Very good reader. And also, I'm happy for Jeff Dyer to buy any of the phrases that I've used in Monocle articles. I don't know if there's a copyright infringement. That's all right, isn't it, Andrew? I can just sell off random lines to esteemed writers. That's all right, isn't it?
It's so funny because I obviously asked the question that tripped him up at the beginning when I said it looked a bit like a magazine come book. I asked him about the format. He said, oh, no, I didn't want it to look like a magazine.
Yeah, exactly. I think you find it's a £25 book. Chill out.
So anyway, a really great team of people.
I loved it. And we'll probably be here same time next week.
Yes.
You're going to be in the hot seat.
I'm going to be here.
My damp patch is going to have dried out by this time next week, and I won't be sitting on the edge of my seat.
If you phone in one day this week and say, I was told, Rob's not coming in, he's got a damp patch.
I do, on my wall. Okay. It's not on my person. I'm just saying.
It's not on your heart.
Shall we thank everybody? We should thank all of our guests today, and we should thank the people behind the glass. We should thank our studio manager, Claire Urban, and our studio producer, added John. For the time being, from me, Robert Pound.
And me, Andrew Tuck.
Thanks for tuning in.